It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. State environmental regulators are finalizing updates of new oil and gas regulations from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection, which includes more stringent rules around permitting, waste handling, water restoration, and identifying old wells. The process began back in 2011 and has seen its share of controversy. Both industry and environmental groups have criticized the effort as either too far-reaching or too weak. Here to take a closer look at what these new rules entail is David Yoxtimer, a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. He joins us by phone. David Yoxtimer, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh. That should be an easy enough name for a guy named Guggenheimer to get, shouldn't it?
Yeah, we Heimers got to stick together.
Exactly. And we'd like to hear from you at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email is ESSPGH@WESA.FM and on Twitter at ESSPGH. What do you think of the proposed new oil and gas regulations? Do the new rules go too far or are they too weak? Again, the number, 412-246-2002. Later in this segment, we'll hear from David Spiegelmeyer. He is president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition based here in Pittsburgh to get his take on the new rules. First, David Yoxtimer, what exactly are these new, stricter oil and gas regulations?
Well, the focus of this latest round of regulatory revisions is really looking at the surface activities associated with oil and gas development, both conventional vertical wells, the type of oil and gas wells have been drilled here in Pennsylvania for many decades, and then the unconventional side, the shale, the Marcellus Shale, the Utica Shale, and looking at the surface activities there. We've got a newer type of technology being used in the last decade here in the state, and how to best protect the environment and public health by use of those new technologies here in the Commonwealth.
So what message is the state DEP trying to send to the oil and gas industry, particularly the fracking industry?
Well, I think the message is, and really I think has been, that you're welcome to operate here in Pennsylvania, but we've got to follow the rules and regulations to make sure that we're not compromising the environment or the general public's health, while also trying to meet our energy needs and sustaining our economy. So there's a balance in there that you need to find.
And of course, as I mentioned at the outset, both industry and environmental groups have criticized the effort as either too far-reaching or too weak. What is your assessment?
Well, I guess my assessment is, if you're not making anybody happy on either side of the spectrum, then you must be doing something right. So I think the DEP and those involved in the process here have tried to find that middle ground, where again you're using the best available technologies to both develop the oil and gas while also protecting the environment, our air, our water, our land, our public resources, and our public health. So again, there's a balance in here, and oftentimes when you've got a sort of a controversial topic that you're working on here, you're never going to please anybody, or everybody at least. So again, you have to find that middle ground and make some compromises in there.
412-246-2002 is the number to call to join the conversation. Again, our email address, ESSPGH@WESA.FM, and on Twitter at ESSPGH. And we have a tweet from Peter who says that the evidence to date indicates fracking operations pose serious threats to health from water contamination and air pollution. Please ask your guest about the Physicians for Social Responsibility fracking study, please. What about that? And David, have you had a chance to familiarize yourself with that and the concerns that it raises?
I'm not familiar with that particular study. But I think, you know, in general, as far as, you know, the DEP and their mission and the work they've done to date, you know, they've done air quality testing. Obviously, there's lots of water quality testing that has occurred. And sure, you know, on some level, there have been detectable impacts. We've got, with respect to water, you know, there have been, you know, on the order of in the last several years, on the order of, you know, 200 plus reported impacts that the DEP has investigated, you know, and based on their assessments, you know, less than half of those complaints or allegations have, you know, resulted in some sort of finding that, you know, the oil and gas industry has been responsible or their operations were responsible for causing some sort of water quality impact. You know, the most common impacts we see are with respect to methane migration, where you have some escape of methane. Typically, that's related to well construction, not hydraulic fracturing. So, you know, if you don't do a sufficient job of sealing off the shallow methane that occurs in the earth in the upper, you know, 2,000 to 3,000 feet, you can have migration of methane into aquifers and end up in people's wells. So we've certainly have seen that. That's been documented. You know, several years ago, there was a revision in the regulations to strengthen the drilling and well construction process to prevent that. And we also see pretty much all operators at this point are doing pre-drill testing of water supplies that are within 2,500 feet or more of a gas well, Marcellus well, or shale well. And so now that you have that pre-drilling data set, if there is an allegation of a water quality impact by a homeowner who has a well or a spring or some other water source, you can go back and, you know, do follow-up testing to see if, in fact, there is, you know, a direct impact from the drilling or potentially hydraulic fracturing process. The other area where you see some impacts are from surface spills of either the fluids that are used in hydraulic fracturing or the brine that comes up after you've hydraulically fractured a well. So typically you'll see a return of fluids on the order of 5 to 10% of what was injected down into the shale to hydraulically fracture the shale. And when a portion of those fluids come back up, they bring up naturally occurring salts and metals and even radionuclides that occurred naturally in the shale. So if you have a spill of those fluids, they could then end up migrating down and getting into groundwater or running off into surface water. So there have been spills. You know, again, the regulations, not so much through this. Well, there have been, you know, new regulations with respect to secondary containment. But, you know, most of the operators started lining their well pads, you know, several years ago to prevent any escape of fluids that do spill at the surface to get into groundwater or surface water. So, again, you know, the industry has certainly strengthened their approach and the regulations have been improved. But there are certainly still risks out there. And so that's, you know, again, part of this rulemaking is to, again, further reduce those risks.
So this is good news. These new rules are good news for people that own property where drilling is taking place or could take place.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, it is, you know, another round of strengthening the regulations. You know, on some level, you know, you learn from experience. And so where there have been, we'll say, gaps in the regulations and, you know, issues out in the field with respect to some sort of spill or contamination, you know, through that experience, the regulations have been are in the process of being improved to, again, prevent and minimize that risk.
412-246-2002 to join our conversation with David Yoxheimer, who is a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. And we have a call from Lois in Scenery Hill. Lois, welcome to Essential Pittsburgh.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just had a question for you. I am heavily impacted by the gas and oil well industry. I have over 12 just gas well pads around my house, a training facility, a day facility. We have the places where they're to go if there's a spill. And so on each one of these pads are 8 to 10 wells. Also, the trucks that speed by it, 70 miles an hour starting at 5 a.m. And I realize that new regulations and stuff are a great thing, and I agree with them completely. But when you say compromising, how much more do we need to compromise on this? It's unbelievable what goes on. My children fish at 10 Mile Creek. It is heavily polluted with lead now. We live 10 minutes from the Dunkard Creek spill. And this isn't mistakes or mishaps. This is people not following regulations. We just got our notice again about our water being heavily polluted. We get one every other month. And this is from the gas and oil industry directly. Well,
let me ask you, Lois, was it polluted before fracking was taking place?
The Monongahela River has always been a bit of an issue, but it was cleaned up for a number of years after the coal industry came through. You know, this is nothing new, but
let me just jump in and make a point here,
sure.
and stay on the line because I want to let David Yoxheimer react to what you're saying. But one of the points, and we're going to hear this in the recorded comments from David Spiegelmeyer, who is president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition.
Mm-hmm.
Is one of the main points of contention here is just how much pollution was already in place before drilling began. And what the industry is saying that they feel is unfair is to be held responsible for pollution that may have existed before they, in other words, they're saying that the water wasn't necessarily clean before they began doing this. And David, I'll let you respond to that and to Lois's concerns.
Thank you.
Stay on the line, Lois.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Dave.
So with respect to, pre-existing water quality issues, there certainly have been a lot of those in Pennsylvania. And that's where, again, the pre-drilling water quality sampling is a really crucial part of the process to make sure that there are not significant changes in water quality from before drilling to after drilling. One thing that complicates that here in Pennsylvania is that we do not have residential well construction regulations. So therefore, there are many wells, private wells out there that people get their drinking water from that may not be constructed properly. They're not properly sealed, and therefore surface contaminants can leak down in and bring things like coliform bacteria into people's drinking water. So that's never a good thing. I think what
right.
we are seeing is with all of the sampling that the industry's done in the last 5+ years is that, there are a lot of pre-existing, water quality issues here in Pennsylvania. Some of the work that Penn State has done has found that about 40% of private wells don't pass for at least one primary drinking water standard. While certainly there have been some impacts by the industry, there is also a lot of, pre-existing conditions with respect to water quality.
Now, Lois is saying that it's gotten, correct me if I'm wrong, Lois, you're saying it's been progressively worse in recent
yes.
years.
Yes, it definitely has gotten progressively worse. And I'm not talking about, I'm talking about our public water, which is from the Monongahela River. And, we get notices every other month about our water being, basically poison. And, then this accident at Dunkard Creek, and this is just a few recent things that I can think of off the top of my head, and then 10 Mile Creek with all the heavy levels of lead. You know, as a child growing up on that river, yes, it was polluted from, the coal industry, but it wasn't at these types of levels. And if it was, we would have been aware of that as children and as an adult growing up around here. And myself moving back to the area and raising 4 kids in the area and just the water alone, not to mention the air contaminants around our home, is unbelievable. And I'm not saying that the gas and oil industry isn't trying to do some things correctly now, but My point is that the regulations have to be put in place for existing and pre-existing wells to see this through and on a federal level. And I think that would help tremendously in everything that goes on in our area since we have been unregulated.
Well, it's certainly very important concerns that you're raising, Lois, and we hope that things improve or get to the point where you're more comfortable with what's happening than you clearly appear to be now. And one of the things that I think is important to ask David Yoxheimer, and I'm not sure if you can answer this, but is the Marcellus shale industry overplaying just how bad the water quality might have been before drilling started?
No, I wouldn't say that. I mean, they, hire out independent labs to collect those water samples and analyze them. So the data is what the data is. So I don't think there's any overplaying or underestimating of, what water quality is in any given scenario. I think, again,
you would understand, though, why David, you would understand why people might be suspicious, though.
No, absolutely. I do understand that. And, there are some, I think you can point to specific instances where, there have been impacts to water quality. And then there are other scenarios where the industry, is alleged to be the culprit, but in fact it's due to, some other industry. With respect to, what goes on in the Monongahela Rivershed, there's a lot of industrial activity, a lot of historic coal mining practices, and, a lot of both conventional and now unconventional oil and gas development. With respect to Dunkard Creek, many pointed at the industry saying that the Marcellus industry saying, they're responsible, but multiple agencies investigated that, and, it was, due to a toxic algae, golden algae, that caused that fish kill. So it wasn't related to a spill, and the Dunkard Creek was already pretty severely degraded by historic coal mining in the region. So that's an example of where the industry had the finger pointed at them, but they didn't as far as best we can tell have anything to do with that. The increase in total dissolved solids in the Monongahela, again, the industry was blamed for that. And, data showed that, they did have some small part potentially in the increase of the total dissolved solids concentration in Monongahela due to, discharges that were occurring back in 2009. But, most of the reason that the water quality got so bad was because the flow got so low. And with all of the pre-existing industrial discharges to the river, there wasn't enough dilution. And so I think that's a big part we need to look at here, is that whatever industry you're in, we can't rely on dilution as the solution to pollution. We got to, make sure, what we're putting in our streams and rivers is, sufficiently treated that we're not causing, water quality impacts, especially to people's drinking water supplies. And Lois, I'd be happy to, speak to you directly if you want to contact me here at the Penn State Marcellus Center and try to, help you look at, the issues you might be facing.
Let's take one more call before we go to break from David in Squirrel Hill. I know we have other people waiting on the line. We will get to you. But David, quickly before we go to break, you have a question.
Yeah, I've wondered for a long time, and nobody seems interested in answering it from the industry. How on earth has the industry, the drilling industry, managed to avoid disclosing the chemicals that they use in the fracking process? Why on earth do they have the legislature cowed so that they will not pass regulations that require the revelation of what chemicals they're using?
Well, it's a good question, David. Certainly, the lobbyists play a part in this, and we know that the Marcellus shale industry contributed money to the campaign of former Governor Corbett. Whether that's had an impact on this, I don't know. David Yoxheimer, what are your thoughts?
Well, that's actually now by law, the industry does have to disclose what is in the fracturing fluid mixture. There is a website, FracFocus, FracFocus.com. And for each well they've drilled since 2011, you can see what specific chemicals were added into the process. The only exemption there is if there is a trade secret, they don't have to reveal precisely what the additive is, but they do have to still reveal what the general class of the additive is, and that exemption is only granted through permission by DEP if, in fact, it is determined to be a an ingredient that is sufficiently unique to their process that it would more or less make them less competitive. So that has been a law on the books here for almost 5 years now.
Jonathan in an email says, just because an industry is polluted does not give the industry the right to continue polluting. We will continue with our conversation with David Yoxheimer, a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research, and also hear from Dave Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition, in our next segment. Stay tuned. We'll continue this discussion. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're discussing the state environmental regulators finalizing updates of new oil and gas regulations from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. They include more stringent rules around permitting, waste handling, water restoration, and identifying old wells. And as you're about to hear, the Marcellus shale industry is not particularly happy with some of these new rules and the way they're being applied. We will talk in just a couple of minutes. We will hear our conversation with David Spiegelmeyer, who is president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition based here in Pittsburgh. On the line with us from Penn State is David Yoxheimer, a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. And David, we're going to take this conversation to the top of the hour. Can you stay with us till 1 p.m.?
Absolutely.
All right, wonderful. We also have callers on the line. We will get to you. But as I mentioned, we invited David Spiegelmeyer, president of the Pittsburgh-based Marcellus Shale Coalition, to join us live on the program today. He was not able to be here during the noon hour. However, we did record an interview with him this morning. And for the next few minutes, let's hear what Mr. Spiegelmeyer had to say, beginning with his assessment of the new rules the state is proposing.
I think the jury's still out. Process is far from complete yet. There still has to go through Environmental Quality Board and some review. But we've been part of this process for some time now to make sure we provide adequate comment and to assess the impact upon industry. The issues that we've raised are significant. They add about $2 million per well for the drilling of natural gas wells, and I want to be careful that not send the signal that that our industry is not focused on a high level of performance in the environmental area for every single well we drill. I think that reviews that have been done of Pennsylvania's regulatory program have showed rigor to their program and meeting their program objectives, that we've worked hard as an industry to make sure we have rigor to our rules in Pennsylvania. The modifications made under Act 13 that provided significant environmental enhancements to the way we drill and the way we manage natural gas development in the Commonwealth has certainly set a standard of rigor, and we've also increased permit fees dramatically that have allowed the DEP to increase staff from under 100 to over 220 today, number two sized oil and gas office in the United States for oversight of oil and gas operations. And I think the reservation that we have today is that there's got to be a cost-benefit analysis done, and you know, we're just getting a look at the cost. Part of the Regulatory Review Act, there are certain checklists or parameters that the department's to take. One of those is a cost-benefit analysis that we just saw for the first time yesterday. So we're taking a look at that. It already looks as though the costs that the department's identified are farly, you know, are dramatically less than what they actually would be on the ground. And again, what we're saying is if you're drilling 1,000 wells in the Commonwealth annually, which is probably on average what we think this play will be, that's an added, you know, couple billion dollars of added cost in this industry every year without environmental benefit to follow.
Right. So as you look at this, then what the question for the industry is weighing the costs of implementing, of adhering to these new rules.
That's correct.
How that, whether that makes the drilling effort as profitable as it needs to be to sustain the industry?
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. And you've got you know, probably the lowest natural gas costs we've seen since the mid-90s. You know, bid week pricing for January 2016 right now is averaging $1.20 with 50 cents to gather to 70 cents to gather. You're talking selling gas in the primary interconnect points of the Commonwealth at 50 to 70 cents, probably the lowest we've seen since the mid-90s. And, you know, the great part of that is for consumers is that, you know, they're going to come out of this winter enjoying some of the, you know, the greatest natural gas prices that we've had for a long time. The opportunities to grow manufacturing are certainly significant, and I think that's a real benefit for the region. But we also want to be able to sustain the development of this industry, the growth of this industry, and the supply chain jobs that we've enjoyed over the last 5 to 7 years as a result of the shale play in Pennsylvania.
Some of the new rules that are in place for drillers, they will now have to identify public resources such as schools and playgrounds. They will also have to identify old or abandoned wells that could be impacted by new drilling. If a water supply is tainted, the driller will have to restore or replace it to federal Safe Drinking Water Act standards. As you look at these new rules, how would you assess them?
You know, you can take every one of those and take issue. You know, the replacement of water, I mean, we're finding Pennsylvania does not have water well construction standards to begin with. A lot of folks in Pennsylvania think our water quality is great, but actually what we're finding with much of the before we drill a natural gas well, we're required by Act 13 to do pre-drill water well sampling. What we're finding is in many cases, private water wells don't meet public drinking water standards to begin with. And the number of criteria that you test, that one comment that you made about replacement of water, if at some point it's determined that one issue in that water sample that after we're done drilling has changed, we may be required to replace water to public drinking water standard when that water well to begin with didn't meet public drinking water standard.
So you're saying that these rules are an overreach?
It adds a burden. There's no doubt about that. A significant burden. The public resource piece, adding, you know, certainly our operators work directly with communities in which we operate. That's almost a given in this business, is to engage with the local government folks, the communities in which we operate. But the expansion of the public resource piece is also a concern. We've just seen the final document on this, or the final release from the department yesterday, so we're still digging through a lot of that. But there are serious concerns here. And again, when I talked about the cost-benefit analysis, we would have liked to have seen that up front. It's part of any regulatory review process to have that up front, and we haven't seen that till yesterday.
So what changes would you want to see? Clearly, there are things that are jumping out at you that are causing concern to the Marcellus shale industry. So if you were to suggest a list of changes that you would make to revamp this, what would they be?
I think it would be a rollback of the clock to take a look at what's actually happening in the Commonwealth. What we've seen is heightened inspections across the state and a greater level of compliance since this began. The last time Pennsylvania had made modifications to its Oil and Gas Act was 1984. Since this industry began, roughly 2008, 2009 is when folks touched the gas pedal on shale development in Pennsylvania. There have been serious modifications and enhancements made to Pennsylvania's regulatory program. And the coalition for which I represent has been a part of trying to increase the size of the department's inspection staff and the compliance staff there. increase in permit fees. An average natural gas well permit in 2008 was $100 a well. Today it's $5,000, a pay-as-you-go system.
So what are your thoughts about the process of finalizing these updates? I mean, this began back in 2011 in earnest. It's taken a long time.
Sure it has. There's a defined regulatory process that every regulation is to follow. If there's an issue that I think that we have raised and will raise, is that process wasn't followed very well. The cost-benefit analysis piece that is one that was important to our industry and certainly hasn't been followed, knowing what the issues were up front would have certainly been of some benefit. So, that's probably the most significant is that cost-benefit piece, but also the statement of need. When we talked about the enhancements made, there are, as I said, that primary checklist. The statement of need is also part of that checklist, and we really haven't seen in some areas, the desire or need to make a modification when those modifications have now been made and in some cases going to add significant cost for the development of natural gas resources in the Commonwealth.
For those who are critical of the Marcellus Shale industry, what would you say about the industry in terms of the positive things, in your view, that it has brought to the area?
Yeah, it's not just the jobs and the economic piece. You know, a lot of folks don't realize that nearly every single consumer product that we touch today is manufactured through the use of natural gas. A lot of folks think it's just for heating your home, cooking your food, drying your clothes, heating your hot water. But nearly every consumer product that we touch today is manufactured through the use of natural gas, including life-sustaining medications and pharmaceutical medications. Today, 1 in 3 electrons that we use in our home are being manufactured through, generated through the use of natural gas that has reduced in one of the few countries in the world that is actually improving air quality and have lessened our greenhouse gas emissions. Why? Because natural gas is now being used in power generation. We're at a 23-year low in carbon dioxide emissions across the globe the U.S., made in part because of the use of natural gas and power generation. We are improving our climate through the use of a clean fuel like natural gas. The other piece that a lot of folks often dismiss is that we're certainly in the dialogue today moving towards a renewable society, one that folks want to embrace wind and solar. Those are interruptible sources of power that don't work well without having a baseload fuel like natural gas. We believe that we're a great partner with wind. We're a great partner with solar. We need to have our baseload fuels at our fingertips to be able to continue to have, life-sustaining, energies that come into, I'm active in one of the local boards of the hospital. So when you think about a child in incubation that's born prematurely without uninterrupted power 365 days a year, 24 hours a day, those children die. It's a matter, I don't want to trivialize it. It's a matter of life or death. If we don't have power 365 days a year around the clock, it's a matter of life or death. So I take it very, very seriously, the work that we're doing to produce our natural gas resources. I get the fact that it needs to be done in an environmentally responsible fashion. I think nearly every member around our board table think the same way. We're Pennsylvanians that we're not all folks from Texas, as they're often the case that the accusation made. We've got folks from Pennsylvania that like to hike and bike and hunt and fish and camp, enjoy our outdoors. We want to make sure it gets done right. And I'm really proud of the work that our folks have done to make sure it gets done in an environmental responsible fashion.
And again, that was Dave Spiegelmeyer, president of the Marcellus Shale Coalition. David Yoxheimer with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research on the line with us. The takeaway is that the Marcellus Shale industry is not happy about these regulations. Does Mr. Spiegelmeyer have a point when he says that these rules are an overreach?
Well, any regulated industry would prefer that, the level of regulation be, sort of nominal. So whether you're, manufacturing chemicals or you're an exploration and production company, and you have the potential to harm the environment, you need to be, you know, have some level of regulation. And so, you know, I can certainly understand, you know, where the, you know, the industry is coming from. You know, I've been on many well pads, many drill rigs, many fracking sites. And I see it. I get it. I understand that, you know, safety is the number one priority at those sites. I agree that, you know, the many of the industry employees are native Pennsylvanians, and they're as much of an environmentalist as, you know, anybody. And so, you know, I certainly have seen it directly that, you know, these folks, you know, don't want to come in and, you know, sort of, you know, pillage the environment. So, you know, they're doing an important job. They're producing the energy that our society uses. And so unless you're willing to go off the grid, you know, you're using their product. So again, it's a tricky balance, trying to, you know, maximize the benefit of the energy while minimizing, you know, some of the inherent risks with it. So again, it's a tough balance. And I think, you know, the regulations, you know, are, you know, another level of refinement, based on what the regulators have seen out there in the field and what they feel are, you know, necessary, sort of precautionary regulations to ensure that, you know, it's done the right way.
You can join our call. I'm sorry. Let me jump in with a phone number and we'll take some calls here, David. Can join our conversation at 412-246-2002. That's 412-246-2002. Email esspgh@wesa.fm. On Twitter at esspgh. Let's go to Douglas in Pittsburgh with a question for our guest, David Yoxheimer. Hi, Douglas. Welcome.
Hello, David. My question is simply this, is that with these regulations coming forward, how do you construct a regulatory format when Pennsylvania, which started fracking in 2006, has never really conducted any environmental impact studies, whether it's on the natural environment or the built environment, and has not conducted any health impact studies? And to this very day, the Pennsylvania Department of Health has not really done any kind of epidemiological work or anything else like that. And the second part of this is,
well, let's start with that, Douglas. Let me jump in and let's have David take the first part of your question, which is how can we have new regulations when Pennsylvania has not conducted health or environmental studies? What about that, David?
Right. So, you know, basically the way the regulations, you know, have been historically set up and are, you know, currently structured is that, you know, each site is looked at sort of individually, each permit is looked at individually. And if, you know, there is a potential for an adverse impact to the environment, whether it be water or air or public health or public resources, then, you know, the new regulations and to a certain degree, the previous version of the regulations, you know, have provisions in there to make sure that the environmental and public health risks are minimized. You know, Doug's right. There's not been a sort of a statewide environmental impact assessment done, which would be, you know, a very complex attempt to look at what the you know, ultimate impacts of the industry are. It's almost sort of impossible, really, I think, to look out at that, you know, full build out scenario. You know, if we look at how much gas is in the Marcellus alone here in Pennsylvania, you're looking at about a, you know, 20 to 25 year supply of gas for the entire U.S. That would require maybe, you know, upwards of 100,000 wells to be drilled to tap into that formation. So there is certainly potential for, you know, long-term environmental impacts if the industry, you know, doesn't perform according to the regulations. But I do think if, you know, the regulations are followed, that risk is minimized. And I think you could even make the argument that, you know, by using natural gas, we are using a lighter carbon fuel source, and also has much lower emissions compared to other fossil fuels. But I think we do need to keep in mind this still is a fossil fuel. It's not renewable. And we do need to start to look at this as a source of fuel that can complement, as Dave Spiegelmeyer said, renewable sources of energy such as wind and solar. So, again, by no means is natural gas the end-all perfect source of energy, but yet I do feel that it can provide a very important source of energy going forward that, again, puts us on a lighter carbon energy diet.
Douglas, quickly, what was the second part of your question?
I take great issue with that response in that, one, he does acknowledge that there's no environmental impact studies, no health risk assessments, no anything, but this is all good. And my response is that, prove it. You know, you're the moving party. You're the one changing the landscape of Pennsylvania in many ways, economically, environmentally, you name it, politically, and so forth. But we have no baseline to talk about. And I also took great issue with his characterization of the algae in Dunkard Creek. Oh, it was just some yellow algae. That algae does not bloom in fresh water. It only blooms in salt water. And then we had David Shipman, who was convicted of dumping all over Washington County, was the likely source of the dumping in the mine that poisoned Dunkard Creek. Additionally, when I was on Pittsburgh City Council and Doug Shields, in 2010, I had meetings with Penn American Water regarding the conditions in the Monongahela water, and the head chemist was sent by the CEO, and we went over it. I was shocked at what they were finding.
Well, what is the second part of your question, Douglas, very quickly?
These are minimal things when, in fact, in 06, as you point out, we didn't have any regulation, as Dave Spiegelmeyer mentioned, since 84. 06, we start drilling. And then in 6 years later, we arrive at Act 13, which has its own problems. And what happened is that dumping was permitted through public wastewater treatment plants, suggesting to the public that this water was being made clean again or somewhat acceptable, when in fact it was merely being diluted and aggregating in the Mon River. You might as well just take the truck and dump it. And that later had to get shut down after 2 or 3 years of activists protesting it and pointing to the science behind it, and everybody poo-pooed it until all of a sudden the Mon River was distressed, and Penn American Water, which takes its water intake from Brownsville and here in Pittsburgh at Beck's Run, was highly alarmed, and so much so that they sent their head chemist to meet with me in my office to show me the data. So, this idea that there's all these benefits are out there. I don't hear David Yoxheimer pointing to what's wrong, and that's what's at issue here.
All right, well, Douglas, that's a good point. That's a good point. I thank you. We have to move on. Douglas is saying that that whatever benefits there are to what the industry is bringing economically, they don't outweigh the environmental concerns. Bridget, in an email, says the DEP has 260 confirmed cases of water contamination. Why doesn't the industry use tracers so we know where the contamination comes from? David, do you want to take that?
Well, the use of tracers to trace contamination directly back to any given industry, whether it be oil or gas or some other industry that has potential environmental contaminants with it, is rather complicated. It's not just as easy as saying, hey, let's put red dye on this site, and if we see it show up in our water someday, then we'll know where it came from. There are certain elements that are often associated with the brine that's associated with Marcellus.
But you're saying it's not. But you're saying I have to jump in because we need to get to a break. But you're saying that it's not as easy to trace those as someone might suggest.
Well, but there are certain indicators such as barium, strontium, high chlorides that you could use as a proxy to begin to investigate whether it's a shale related, and then do a more site-specific study.
Okay, David, we'll take a break here. We're talking with David Yoxheimer from Penn State's. He's a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. We'll take more calls and wrap it up when we come back. It's Essential Pittsburgh on 90.5 WESA. It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. We're talking about new oil and gas regulations from the Pennsylvania Department of Environmental Protection. The state environmental regulators are finalizing those proposed more stringent rules about permitting, waste handling, water restoration, and identifying old wells with regard to fracking and other aspects of oil and gas industry work being done in the area. And on the line with us is David Yoxheimer, our guest, a hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. We have time for a couple more calls. First, an email from Lynn, who says, early in the Bush administration, Dick Cheney met with the oil and gas industry. The outcome was that chemicals involved in the fracking process were prohibited from being disclosed to interested parties and the public. Let's go to Patrick in Pittsburgh, and then we'll take Carlana. Patrick, first, you're up.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that the notion that the wind stops and the sun sets is a failed and archaic notion of an old industry. If you set up wind turbines all over the entire planet and not just here in the United States or just here in Pennsylvania, and solar panels all over the planet and have a global power grid, then no, the sun never sets, and no, the wind never stops.
Well,
so that assumption is a false one.
It's an interesting point. Other people have made that assumption. We hear that a lot. That there isn't enough, alternative energy or green energy to meet our needs. But Patrick, you raise an interesting point. Let's go to Carlana in East Liberty. Carlana, you'll be our last caller. Go ahead.
Okay,
Very quickly.
Important issue that is dead silence, apparently, is the threat of earthquakes that are caused by the fracking industry. And actually, there were earthquakes in Ohio, as close as Ohio, a few years ago, and they're starting to monitor for earthquakes in Pennsylvania. Pennsylvania is one of the worst states in the union for sinkholes, which is when your house or your building disappears in a hole.
Well, there's certainly been, we've talked about this on the show, in Oklahoma recently, Oklahoma has seen a dramatic and alarming increase in earthquakes. They're averaging about 3 a day. Whether or not it's related to fracking is, the jury's still out somewhat on that. And David, what about that? I'm sure you've been hearing those concerns.
Yeah, I think we need to make a clear distinction here. When you are fracturing a well and fracturing the shale, indeed you are creating minute amount of seismicity, generally not the kind of seismicity we'd ever feel at the Earth's surface. For us to feel it, you need to have a seismic event on the order of 2.5 or 3 on magnitude. Fracking generally, under most circumstances, does not impart that much energy down in the earth so that we would feel it. Where we are feeling seismicity in some parts of the states is with the wastewater that's associated with development of oil and gas. So the brine that is produced, co-produced along with the oil or gas, needs to be disposed of in some environmentally sound manner.
David, let me jump in very quickly. Do you anticipate state environmental regulators making any changes based on reaction from the Marcellus shale industry? We're down to 10 seconds.
At this point, I think the regulations are, need to go past EQB. There may be some minor modifications at that point. As a member of the Technical Advisory Board, we made some comments, but I don't think we're going to see any drastic changes from where they stand at this point.
Okay, David Yoxheimer, hydrogeologist with Penn State's Marcellus Center for Outreach and Research. Thank you so much for being with us today.
My pleasure. Thank you very much.
And we will get to our segment on the Pennsylvania Farm Show, which will be actually taking place tomorrow. So tomorrow's a good day to get to that. We'll do that on Essential Pittsburgh. on Friday. Until then, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. So long for now.